Okay, for those of you who came late, my name again is Rabbi Shlomo Weissman. I serve as the Menahel, the director of the Beis Din of America. It's good to be here this morning, and thank you all for coming. One of the purposes of this morning's seminar is to introduce people put on display the actual work that we do at the Beis Din of America. Is the calendar on? And I thought that a good way to do that was to actually run through an actual case that that we heard a few years ago. This is somewhat typical for the kind of case, the size of the case, the types of issues that we sometimes deal with at the Beth Din of America. And I do have PowerPoint slides to accompany the presentation, but if the projector is not working, that's not going to work, so we'll just move ahead without it. If it starts working, people here want to see it.
Take the projector
to Bezdin, yeah. If it starts to work, the people on this side are welcome to shift over to that side, but we'll start without the PowerPoint. Typically, when I speak in public about cases, obviously I don't share the names of the parties, but moreover, I will always change the industry and a few pertinent facts of the case in order to shield the identity, to maintain confidentiality, obviously. I'm sorry? You want to cut the lights? Okay, thank you. In this situation, actually, we got permission from the parties to publish the case, to publish the decision after we anonymized, we changed the name. So I'll be able to actually talk about the actual case. This was a case that we heard a few years ago. The claimant was a company that we'll call United Savings LLC. It was in the industry of utility cost, it was a utility cost savings consultant, which means that it's a company that will actually go into a business's utility bills, review the bills, and figure out opportunities for saving costs on their utility payments, negotiate better rates with the utility, with the energy providers, and in return for that service, they get a cut of any savings that are realized on the utility bills. So this particular company, United Savings LLC, entered into an agreement with a nursing home operator that owned a few facilities. As you'd expect, nursing homes generate high utility bills. And so they agreed to review the utility bills, to negotiate with the energy providers, and they would get 33% of any cost savings that they realized based on actual savings realized and the next 30 months projected. That was the formula set forth in the contract. So they signed this contract with the nursing home operator. We'll call them Dunkirk Center for Health, Inc. And they ended up saving them lots and lots of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars in utility bills when you count the actual savings and then the projected 30 months of savings. What happened was that the nursing home operator, Dunkirk, didn't want to pay their cut, their 33%. And United Savings filed an application at the Beis Din of America in order to bring them to a Din Torah to recover the 33% that they said they were entitled to under the contract. The way you do this is you go online at bethdin.org, there's a click a button there to open a new case. They put in their contact information, the defendant's contact information, and we ask the plaintiff to provide a brief summary of their claim. And the reason for that is because when we send a hazmana, that slide. When we send a hazmana to the defendant, we attach a claim letter which describes the claim. This way the recipient of the hazmana knows what we're talking about, knows why we're contacting them, what the gist of the claim against them is. And so we'll send out a hazmana that looks exactly like that. We've been contacted by the plaintiff on behalf of United Savings LLC, who has requested that we summon you, Dunkirk Center for Health, to a Din Torah. We attach a copy of the claim letter, as I mentioned, and then we ask them to respond to that summons, to respond to hazmana by a certain date, by a deadline. And we specify here that we're not asking necessarily for a substantive response to the hazmana, to the claim, but rather just an indication of whether or not you're prepared to sign an arbitration agreement to submit the dispute to the Beis Din of America for adjudication. And then if that deadline passes and there's been no response to the hazmana, we'll follow up with a second hazmana, a third hazmana. Ultimately, we'll issue a letter typically that warns of the imminent issuance of a seiruv, and where appropriate, based on the discretionary decision ultimately at the level of the Av Beis Din, or the Skan Av Beis Din of the Beis Din, will issue a Seiruv, as Rabbi Willig mentioned, for a defendant who refuses to come to the Beis Din, or refuses to come to any Beis Din that they're prepared to go to. In this situation, in this case, the parties ended up signing an arbitration agreement and submitting the matter to a Din Torah before the Beth Din of America. And so we scheduled hearings, and at the hearing, the defendant raised the following two objections to the plaintiff's claim that they were obligated to pay. The first objection that they raised was that they naturally would have realized some of these savings on their own. Prices would have fluctuated, they would have themselves negotiated better rates, and so therefore the baseline for calculating the actual savings shouldn't be their actual rate at the time of contract, but it should have been adjusted downward to a lower rate that they would have kind of figured out on their own how to negotiate. And that would have resulted, if you do the math, if you subtract, that would have resulted in a much lower savings. As you see at the top left, the part that's not cut off, the plaintiff's calculation was that the total savings were about $743,000. Again, computing it based on actual savings and 30 months projected, a third of that gets you to about $247,000, whereas the defendant's calculation was much more modest. They said the actual savings, once you take into account what we would have done on our own anyway, was only $111,000, and that means we only owe you about $37,000. So you see there's a pretty big spread here, and good enough reason to come to a arbitration, to a Din Torah, and litigate this issue out. This is actually language from the decision where the Dayanan described this part of the dispute. They said it's reasonable to assume that over time its negotiated rate would have actually been lowered to a different amount, and therefore they thought that they should only be required to pay $37,000, roughly $37,000. So that was the first objection that they raised. The second objection that they raised was a little more complicated and more interesting from a legal and halachic perspective, and that is that they said that at the time that United Savings approached them and negotiated this whole arrangement to negotiate their utility their utility costs and to get a third of the savings, the guy they met with at corporate headquarters wasn't an owner of the business. He was the brother-in-law. He was the guy who happened to have an office and was probably on the business's healthcare plan or something like that. But he was not anyone in any position to negotiate and bind the business as a legal matter. And so they argued that we shouldn't be bound by the terms of this contract because we didn't enter into a contract. There's no such deal. We don't owe you 33%. You might have done all the work. You might have done all the work, but we don't owe you anything for it. We didn't enter into any such contract. This is a good point to pause and just say that for the people watching at home online, the CLE password that you're going to need to enter into the form in order to get CLE credit is breakfast. That's this morning's password. So again, if you're watching online, just type in breakfast. You could either enter in the form now and do it for each segment, or you could wait till the end and enter in for all the segments. For this first segment, the password is breakfast. Okay, so the Dayanim were faced with these two issues. Number one was calculating the actual savings and therefore and thereby the amount that they owed. What is the third of what? And the second issue was whether or not the contract was valid altogether and whether or not they owed any money for the services that United Savings LLC performed. And so the Dayanim held hearings. I think this case actually went over the course of four hearings because there were a whole bunch of witnesses because there was a lot of testimony taken about the various rates, all sorts of complications when it comes to utility rates. And so there was a good amount of hearing time spent on this. The Dayanim on this particular case consisted of kind of a cross-section of the type of Dayanim that we typically will staff on cases. So one of the dayanim was a business professor at NYU School of Business, a very well-respected member of the community. Leon Metzger, he sat as one of the three dayanim. Another one of the dayanim was a community rabbi, and the third dayan was, I think, an attorney who's also a rabbi who kind of had that cross-section of that expertise. Generally speaking, when we hear cases, business cases, commercial disputes, invariably there's going to be at least one lawyer who sits on the panel, whether it be a lawyer exclusively or a lawyer who's also a rabbi who has the kosher and mishpat expertise. There might be a business person, there might be two rabbis. We kind of have a roster of dayanim that we pull from with all sorts of expertise, both in the areas of kosher and mishpat, of Jewish monetary law, but also in with an understanding of the marketplace, with an understanding of the complexity of commercial cases, because obviously, as you can imagine, that's important, and especially when dealing with any level of complexity in a complex commercial case, you need the expertise. You need the dayanim to have a deep understanding of how LLC agreements work, how commercial transactions generally work, in order to ask the right questions, in order to focus in on the right issues, and then together the panel works kind of cohesively to arrive at a result. So that was those were the two issues that the dayanim were facing in this particular case. And the first issue they dealt with by simply looking at the language of the agreement. And I'll read from of the agreement that the parties had signed. And I'll read from the decision. It says, the respondent asserts that certain savings would have been realized even without the efforts of the claimant. Were a binding contract not in effect, we would be sympathetic to such an assertion. The agreement, however, states that if a course of action suggested by the claimant is substantially implemented and a credit refund or saving is achieved, the respondent will compensate the claimant. The language was clear that this was an exclusive arrangement, that if after the time of the contract they realized any savings as a result of any efforts done by the claimant, by United Savings LLC, United Savings was entitled to 33% of the cost savings, and it didn't have any carve out for any kind of excuses like we would have figured that out ourselves or the prices would have gone down on their own. That was the clear language of the contract. And then they continue, as a matter of New York law, contracts are to be interpreted in line with their plain meaning. And it cites to case law, to New York case law. Now, you might wonder why we're citing to New York case law in a Beis Din decision that's presumably to be governed by Jewish law. And without giving away the punchline to Rabbi Reese's presentation, which is next, which we'll talk a little bit about the interplay of secular law and halacha and why secular law is sometimes relevant to Beis Din proceedings, the answer really is that Jewish law often looks to secular law and secular custom, to the customs of the marketplace, to minhagas ochrim, to determine what the expectations of the parties was. Generally speaking, halacha recognizes kol tanai shebamamon kayim. Generally, halacha recognizes that parties are free to contract to terms that might be at variance with what halacha says. Now, the truth is, this is not a very controversial statement to say that the plain terms or the plain meaning of a contract governs. Halacha would probably approach this in a very similar fashion. Slides are all messed up. Halacha would probably approach this in a very similar fashion, but at least to explain why New York law was relevant to this case, it's important to keep that in mind. This particular case involved a contract that had a New York governing law provision, which made it all the more clear to us and to the dayanim that New York law was the relevant set of laws that govern the expectation of the parties, and that should really be utilized in looking to the outcome of this case. And so they continue and say the agreement did not include carve-out language that excluded from compensation savings that ultimately could have been achieved by the respondent without the intervention of the claimant, as we said. We are therefore prepared to award compensation to the claimant based upon the full savings it achieved for the respondent. So the dayanim concluded that if there is a contract, which we'll get to in a moment, if there is an agreement here, You apply New York law because there was a New York governing law provision. New York law says you look at the plain meaning of the contract. When you look at the plain meaning of the contract, there's no excuses here, and the business, the nursing home operator, owed the utility cost savings consultant the full 33% of the full savings realized, which would have, as we saw, come to a good chunk of change, about $247,000. So that was how they dealt with the first issue. The second issue is a little more complicated, although not very complicated from the perspective of secular law. As many of us know, under secular law, there is a doctrine called apparent authority, which it means that if I go and do business with someone, if I enter into a contract with someone or do any other kind of deal with someone, and I had every reason to believe that they are an authorized representative of the entity which I think I'm doing business with, and it's not because they committed some kind of overt fraud that I should have been more careful about, but because the entity kind of set them up in a situation that gives them that apparent authority, where it appears to the naked eye, to the person dealing with that company, that this person is authorized to act, so then their actions bind the company. If I walk into a Verizon store and I open up a cell phone plan and I expect some benefits from that cell phone plan, Verizon can't later repudiate the agreement with me by saying, oh, that guy who was our salesman didn't really have the corporate authority to enter into a contract with you. You needed to really enter into a contract with Verizon's senior vice president for sales. That's clearly not the case. That person, that salesperson sitting in the Verizon store has at least the apparent authority, if not the explicit authority, to bind Verizon. And as a consumer, I have every right to walk into a Verizon store and expect that when I sign the contract with Verizon, I'll get the full benefits of that contract. I can rely on the apparent authority of the salesperson who's doing business. And so here again, the Besden quoted New York law. Although JB, who was that was the initials for the guy who actually entered into the contract with United Savings, although he was not technically authorized to bind the respondent, he possessed apparent authority to do so. And they go into some detail about the fact that the guy had an office there in the headquarters. Everything he did was set up in a way that made it appear as if he had the authority to bind the company. And United Savings had no reason to expect, no reason to think that their agreement wouldn't be honored, that he didn't have the actual authority to enter into the contract. And then they quote the case. As a matter of New York law, a principal is bound by a transaction entered into by its agent where the principal's conduct creates the appearance that the agent has such authority. That's the doctrine of apparent authority under New York law. But here the Diana ran into a logical snafu, a little bit of a quagmire. The contract said that New York law governs, and so it's logical to bring in New York law in any dispute dealing with this transaction. But the Dunkirk, the nursing home operator, they were arguing that in this situation, there wasn't even a contract. So you didn't even get to the governing law provision, right? It's not as even they had conducted any business, so to speak, with United Savings. From the perspective of the healthcare operator, of the nursing home operator, United Savings was a complete stranger to them. And so you couldn't argue that they agreed to a governing law provision and that therefore apparent authority should apply. And you couldn't even argue that they, even without a written agreement, that they kind of both entered into this transaction with an implicit understanding that secular custom would apply. Because from their perspective, this guy was a total stranger. United Savings had no business negotiating rates on their behalf and no business saving money and had no business, therefore, collecting a percentage of the savings. That was the argument that the nursing home operator, brought to the Besden. And they said, furthermore, under halacha, there's no such thing as apparent authority. Apparent authority is something that you need nowadays when we have entities, when we have businesses operating and doing business with people in an impersonal manner. You have an entity that has corporate officers and then it has representatives doing business. And so in order to preserve the ability for businesses to conduct business in the marketplace and for people to be able to rely on who it is they're doing business with. So secular law has developed this notion of apparent authority. But there's nothing specific in halacha about apparent authority. And if so, argued the nursing home operator, we're in a bezdin. Secular law doesn't apply unless you bring it in by virtue of some sort of idea that that the minhag sochrim, that the expectation of the parties was for secular law to apply. And therefore, we're not at all bound by this contract. We can completely walk away from it. That was the argument that the nursing home operator brought. So the Dayanim had a little bit of a... So the Dayanim had a little bit of a challenge here. And here's how they addressed the issue in a few different ways. They kind of marshaled a few separate arguments, halachic arguments, to get around this problem and to reach the conclusion that the contract would be binding. Because the Dayanim kind of approached this from the perspective of, here was a situation where, by all rights, this contract should be binding. They got the benefit of the service provided. The guy who entered into the contract on behalf of the nursing home operator did have apparent authority, meaning certainly looked to the innocent United Savings that this guy was authorized to bind the company. And the right answer really should be that this contract should be binding. United Savings should get the benefit of the contract. And so the first argument they marshaled was the following. They said, the doctrine of apparent authority is a creature of secular law with no equivalent theory under halacha. But they've said the following. By engaging in commerce through the mechanism of a corporation or a limited liability company, the respondent, however, has implicitly agreed to be bound by Dina de Malchusa, by secular law, and by the customs that generally pertain to corporate entities and limited liability companies. So even though it's true, they said, that you usually get secular law and you usually get minhag ha'sochrim into a din Torah by talking about a mutual expectation of parties, by what the parties each agreed, how they each agreed for their transaction to be governed, and here you don't have that. But here, the nursing home operator was operating in the public marketplace. They were operating through a entity that operates under New York State law, and by every expectation they should have had, they're subject to the rules of the secular marketplace. They operate in the kind of minhag ha'sochrim that applies to entities generally. And so they argued that even though there was no privity, in a sense, there was no mutual agreement for secular law and for secular doctrines to apply, still they should be governed by this notion of apparent authority and they should be on the hook. That was the first argument that the Dayanim raised. The second argument that the Dayanim brought to this case was more of an indigenous halachic argument. And they kind of looked around and they saw that, in fact, in Hilchos Shlichos, there is such an idea, perhaps, of something kind of like apparent authority. And they specifically quoted a shach who says that in a situation where a harshah has been signed, so halacha recognizes the idea of shlichos, of appointing an agent to conduct one's business. This applies in all areas of halacha. If I want to get married, I'm allowed to appoint an agent to marry someone on my behalf. If I want to get divorced, I could appoint an agent to write a get and deliver it on my behalf. But it also applies in the commercial context. If I want to transact business, I can appoint an agent, a shaliach, to go buy something on my behalf, and his actions are deemed just like my actions, and he can effect a transaction on my behalf. That's what a shliach can do. One way that I could evidence the appointment of a shliach is through a harshah, a power of agency, a power of attorney, a written authorization for this person to conduct business on my behalf. And so the shach in Choshen Mishpat is dealing with the situation of someone who authorized a shaliach to conduct business on his behalf, and he signed a written harshah evidencing that authorization. And then the shaliach goes off, And this is before the days of cell phones, or his cell phone was turned off. He goes far, far away, maybe even to another continent, to transact business on my behalf. And then I have a change of heart, and I decide to revoke his authority. I no longer want this shliach to bind me. And so I revoke the shliach's authority. In the meantime, the shliach is off in another continent, and he's doing business on my behalf. And when he does business with, let's say, sellers of merchandise, who are going to give him the merchandise on credit, he does so by presenting the harsha that I signed that makes it very clear to the sellers of merchandise that I'm on the hook and that this guy, this shliach, is authorized to buy merchandise on my behalf. Now, in the meantime, my harsha has been revoked. I silently and quietly and sneakily took away his authorization. The question is that shliach still able to bind me even after I've revoked his shlichus? And the shach says that clearly you have to say that the shliach is still bound by the harsha. I'm still bound by the harsha. The shliach can still act on my behalf even after I've revoked the shlichus. And sellers of merchandise can rely on that written harsha, even though technically it's fallen by the wayside. And so Dayanim said, if that's true with the respect to a shliach and with our harsha, perhaps that's true, generally speaking, as well. Meaning, perhaps the shach was articulating a general stance that you can rely on what seems apparent, on apparent authority. Just like the seller of merchandise can rely on this revoked harsha because it appears like the shliach has that authorization, so too, in this modern context, I can rely, or in this situation, United Savings, the utility cost savings consultant, was justified in relying on this individual's authority to bind the company because he seemed to justifiably be authorized to bind the company. That was the argument that these Dayanim set forth. Oop, hold on. Okay, I think I have. Here's the argument as they wrote it. According to a strict interpretation of halacha, the claimant should have ascertained from the respondent the scope of the authority of JB and was not permitted to rely on JB's representation alone. And he bore, meaning United Savings, bore the risk that JB was not authorized to bind the respondent. Notwithstanding that, the argument can be made that halacha itself recognizes some concept of apparent authority based on the view of the shach. The shach addresses the case of an agent who was authorized in writing, but where the principal later revoked the agent's authority. The third party, unaware of the revocation, acted in reliance on the written harsha presented to him by the agent, and the halacha recognizes the validity of that transaction. And so Dayanim said, we think it's reasonable to argue that shach's opinion is not limited to a case where there was a valid shlichus that was later revoked, but that such opinion applies to any case where the third party acted reasonably in reliance on the validity of the agency. The reasonableness of relying on an individual's capacity as a shaliach is based on the circumstances of the particular case. As described above, it's our view that in the contemporary business context, the claimant reasonably relied on JP's apparent authority. So the Dayanim, in a sense, invented a halachic doctrine of apparent authority based on this shach. And that was one of the arguments they threw out. So far, they had two. One was based on the minhag ha-sochrim, that by doing business in the secular marketplace, by abiding by the LLC laws, by getting the benefits of being an entity, you kind of play by the rules of the secular marketplace, and that's why apparent authority works. The second argument was that they had an indigenous halachic argument based on this shach for a doctrine of apparent authority. There were two other arguments that they threw in just for good measure to round out the decision. One was that, as a matter of fact, in this situation, it seems that after this guy JB had entered into this contract with the cost consultant, the business continued to do some level of communication with with United, with the utility cost savings consultant, that indicated that it wasn't just one lone rogue individual who sought to bind the company, but there were at least some people in the office. If it didn't rise to the highest levels of the company, there were at least some people in the office who understood that this was a consultant hired by this company, and they were going to get, and they were getting the benefit. So they then thought that this, in a sense, ratified the contract, even if you can make the argument that as a halachic matter, the contract wasn't valid because the individual who entered into it had no authority to enter into it. But by virtue of the business's continued, doing business, having continued to do business with the cost consultant, they were allowed ratified the contract. They in no way repudiated the contract. That was one argument. The final argument that they made is a halachic doctrine that comes up very often in other cases as well. And that is based on an argument of Yored L'toch Sada Shel Chavero. Halacha recognizes a concept of unjust enrichment, or a quantum merit, which says that if I go and perform a service and in some way benefit the receiver of my services, then there is some argument of unjust enrichment, that the person who benefits from my services should have to pay me the market value of the benefit that I endowed. So here, in this situation, there was no question, based on the facts presented, that United Savings had benefited this nursing home operator in some way. They saved them hundreds of thousands of dollars in utility bills, and so they were entitled in some way to compensation for that service provided. If this had been the only argument in the psak, this might have gotten them somewhere, but it wouldn't perhaps have gotten them to the full third of the amount saved, because under an argument of Yored L'toch Sada Shel Chavero, of unjust enrichment, of quantum merit, you're really only going to get the benefit of the market value of the services provided. And it's arguable what exactly is the market value of these services provided. Maybe they should just pay United Savings for an hourly compensation for the number of hours they worked on this. It's hard to imagine they would have gotten up to $250,000 based on that. You could make the argument that the market rate for this type of service is 33%, and maybe even under Yoru L'toch Sada Shel Chavero argument, you would get that. Even under Yoru L'toch Sada Shel Chavero argument, you'd get to that answer. But luckily, the Dayanim didn't just base their decision on that particular argument. They based it on a series of arguments. As we've described, that's basically the decision in a nutshell. I have a few more minutes till I have to hit my until our CLE requirement is met for the recording. So I'll just talk about one or two other kind of procedural matters that could come up in a case like this. As Jordana Mondra is going to mention in a few minutes in her presentation, in a situation like this, in any case where we issue a decision, one of the unique characteristics of the Beth Din of America under our rules and procedures, and you should each have a copy of the rules and procedures in your packets, is Section 31 provides for a request for modification. You could actually appeal to the Av Beth Din, arguing that the decision contains some sort of mistake. Now, there are a few enumerated bases for a request for modification, and they basically fall into two categories. One is a technical mistake, we got the math wrong, we described something in the decision incorrectly in a way that would cause problems if you were going to confirm the award and ultimately enforce the award. So it's basically just cleanup. And then the other category is that we've made a mistake, that the Dayanim in the case made a mistake of Jewish law. Now, a mistake of Jewish law is a broad category that can really mean they got it wrong for whatever reason. It could even mean that they got the secular law analysis wrong, because as we've described, Jewish law brings in secular law sometimes. And so if they got something fundamentally wrong in the reasoning of the decision, you can submit an application for a modification within 20 days after we issue our decision. And this is proven over the years to be a helpful mechanism for us. It means that we kind of get a second chance at making sure we got everything right. Every once in a while, some mistake will creep into a decision. On somewhat rare occasions, I would say, the decision is actually remanded back to the lower panel of Dayanim to revisit their decision because there really was some sort of mistake of Jewish law, or they got something fundamentally wrong. And so this benefits litigants as well as the Bezdin, in the sense that the Bezdin is able to clean up its opinions before it goes, before it's abided by, or even if there's a motion to vacate the award, we've had a second chance to kind of clean it up. And it benefits litigants as well, in the sense that it's not just three Dayanim who are eyeballing the decision before it's sent out, but there's an appellate Dayan who gets to look at it and make sure that we got it all right. I crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's as well. Under the rules and procedures, it's the Av Bezdin that handles appeals typically, or often the Av Bezdin will assign it to another Dayan, Rabbi Reis, who we'll be hearing from in a minute, very often handles these appeals. And it's another one of the unique characteristics of the Bezdin of America that's set forth in the rules of procedures that makes us a unique forum among other Batei Din that operate in this area. How much longer?
Not even a minute.
Okay. So I hope this is a good overview of the kind of case. This is, you know, the cases that we handle really cover the whole spectrum of the types of business disputes that arise within the community. And, you know, they range from a few $100, a roommate dispute among roommates at Yeshiva University that might rise to a few $100 to many millions of dollars. They're heard, as I mentioned, by a strong a roster of Dayanim with varied legal experience. Even here in the audience today, we have some Dayanim. Judge Jerome Feller, who's a retired federal bankruptcy judge, has sat on cases for us. Professor Keith Sharfman, who's a professor at St. John's, has done good work for the Bez Din of America, writing good reasoned decisions. And that's the kind of talent we draw on that kind of complements the Talmud Chacham talent on the other end as well. So I hope this has been helpful. We're going to take a 2-minute break, and then we'll start the next panel.